This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We are ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel here at the Trumpet Hour. In our studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
On this morning's Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Stephen Fleury talked about just how common it has become in the U.S. to hear accusations of racism, national supremacy, neo-Nazism. All it takes is a dozen or so white nationalists to put together a protest somewhere, and it makes national news. It's proof of what a major problem this is in the United States of America, according to the press. Meanwhile, there is a powerful trend unfolding within Europe that the media don't seem particularly interested in. And as Stephen Fleury brought out, what happened this past week on the streets of Germany shows just how serious this is. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Let me just start by reading you some headlines from or about the events in Germany this week, because they really are dramatic and chilling. Germany's far-right groups are on the march. That was from the Times yesterday. Pogrom mood sweeps Germany over migrants. That was from the Times today. German author Thilo Sarrazin is fueling fear of Muslims. This from France 24. German far-right stages new anti-Merkel protest in Chemnitz. German police suspected of collaborating with neo-Nazis. That's another one. So really some dramatic events coming from Germany just this week. So what happened was this all got started on Sunday. In the early hours of Sunday morning, a man was stabbed in this town of Chemnitz in Germany, East Germany, not too far from Dresden. And we've been hearing more and more about what happened on Sunday morning throughout the week. The picture that we have now is that he was stabbed by a migrant that came over in 2015. This migrant had been arrested before on various different offenses, many of them drug-related. He had then somehow not been deported. He was still out there on the streets, and he killed this guy. So then Sunday, we didn't know that all of that at the start of the week. There was just this rumor began spreading that this individual was stabbed by a migrant. Sunday night, you had these protests as far-right individuals came out there and rioted or attacked migrants, shouted anti-migrant slogans, and the police just lost control completely. They weren't at all expecting this. They even on that night, I think they had to call in support from Leipzig and Dresden, these much larger cities nearby. And so then the next night, there were more protests, much bigger protests. And once again, the police they lost control. They had water cannon, but they just couldn't get control. It seems there are about 5,000 or 6,000 demonstrators, many of them doing Hitler salutes, shouting things like foreigners out, up Deutschland, and nationalist slogans and anti-migrant slogans, physically attacking migrants and police in some cases, throwing bottles, throwing fireworks. You also had about 1,000 people on the left in a counter demonstration, and you had this outbreak of violence on the streets of a German town. German press, some German newspapers referred to it as a civil war on the streets of Chemnitz. It was the largest neo-Nazi rally since 1992. So it was a dramatic moment for Germany, and the German press has obviously focused a lot on this, with politicians and media all having something to say. But it was just the biggest far-right explosion that we've had in years, and it comes directly as a result of the migrant crisis.
So this is something that we've been expecting to some degree to happen at some point, given the political climate that we've seen and the rise of these far-right parties, the support that some of these anti-immigrant parties have been gaining within Germany and even in other European nations. But to see it explode in actual violence on the streets, this is a bit of an escalation in this trend.
That's right. The UN Human Rights Commissioner, he talked about this on Wednesday. He said it's frightening to see how the same devices are being used again, referring to what happened in the 1930s. And he said, I think it's particularly worrisome to see it in Europe because of the enormous traumas that Europe itself has witnessed during the 20th century. So it's a lot of just dramatic events with some very ominous historical parallels.
So you and Brad McDonald wrote an article back a couple of years ago when it became clear that the way that the press was covering this influx of migrants, that there was a fairly deliberate and also among politicians effort to obscure some of the problems that these migrants were creating. They wanted to portray this humanitarian gesture, Angela Merkel opening up Germany's borders to these migrants as, you know, this goodwill gesture that everything is going to work out just fine. And they were covering up events that showed just how much of a problem this was creating within Germany. And essentially the point that you and Mr. McDonald made was that cover-up can't last forever. The problems are going to get worse, and at some point Germany is going to wake up to just how serious a problem this is. That's essentially what we're seeing today.
That's exactly what we're seeing. I mean, this just even earlier this month, there was kind of a big controversy where Germany's public broadcasters, ARD, maybe their equivalent of the BBC, there was a murder where a migrant stabbed a German citizen in the town of Offenbach, and they chose not to report it. Mm-hmm. And this was in a lot of other – well, this did make it out into some other media, but people were asking them, well, why didn't you report on this? And they said, well, look, if it was a German murdering a German – we wouldn't have reported on this. The only thing that makes it remarkable is that it was a migrant doing it. And then they said, well, migrant, if we report it, we give the false impression that migrants are committing more crimes than Germans, or the migrants are more likely to commit crimes than Germans. Therefore, in order to give that false impression, we won't report it. There's a lot wrong with that. And one of the big things that's wrong with that is that statement that migrants are less likely to commit crimes than Germans is false. You can crunch the numbers, and it's very obvious that per head a migrant is more likely to commit crime. Now, ARD, they came back and said, okay, yeah, that isn't true, but migrants are mostly young men, and so therefore we shouldn't – and young men in Germany commit crime more often, so the only reason they're more likely to commit crime is because more migrants contain more young men. Again, even if that's true, surely that's something that a nation should be discussing. Well, if single young men commit a lot of crimes, shouldn't we talk about the wisdom of letting a lot of single young men in? But no, it was almost like they were looking for any excuse not to talk about this migrant crime. Mm-hmm. And it really is. It's full of, or Germany's full of these types of crimes. The editor of The Local, he kind of wrote an article, Mr. Flurry quoted from it in the Trumpet Daily Radio program. He wrote an article, I think it was today or yesterday, where he's stepping down. But he was just giving his thoughts on being an editor of a German publication over the last few years. And again, he talked about just a small town of 19,000 that is in the middle of a sexual assault crisis right now because of migrants. Mm-hmm. You know, they had a 60-year-old woman that was raped, and the all of the descriptions of the person that did it, somebody doesn't speak very German, and their ethnicity, they point them to being a migrant. They suspect them, the police suspect the man is from North Africa. And you've just had this total change in this city where the park is now under a 24-hour watch, and just an outbreak of rape in a small town. So you're having areas of Germany that are, their way of life is being challenged. I mean, Germany before the migrant crisis, you know, there weren't even ticket inspection machines when you go on the subway to catch a train. It was kind of like that's how honest and open the society was. And now you're having that such a change, and yet nobody in the mainstream wants to talk about it. And that's exactly what this article in The Local was talking about. You know, stop just dismissing these problems as racist East Germans. There is a genuine and a serious problem, and nobody's talking about this. And so all of these people are going to the only people that will talk about it, and that is these fringe parties. These extreme parties, it's parties like the ARD. And you read what the media, they interviewed people who were there at some of these demonstrations and riots on Monday night. And a lot of the people they interviewed were not the ones throwing rocks or throwing firecrackers or doing Nazi salutes. They were just ordinary Germans who were fed up with these migrant crisis, who were fed up with the problems, who were worried about Germany and the future for their children. But the only people that would listen to them and who will organize protests are the ones that will give Nazi salutes and right. throw rocks at migrants.
Well, I think that's a really important point, because you mentioned, say, the second night of these demonstrations, 5,000, 6,000 people, considering that, I mean, that's a whole lot of people who are out there actually committing violence in the streets or, staging that kind of an uprising. But you would imagine that for every one of those Germans, that there would be a whole lot of people who are not the extremists. They're not saluting Nazi salutes, who just can recognize that there is a problem and that something needs to be done. This is actually a major point that you bring out in that article. This is a 2016 article that you and Brad McDonald wrote, Germany, Migrants, and the Big Lie, that the Merkel government's handling of the situation is turning the German people into a ticking time bomb. The more disillusioned, frustrated, and angry the German people become, the more vulnerable they will be to radical politics and radical leaders with radical solutions. So we've been That's talking right. a long time about just how there is going to be some strongman stand up and take advantage of that climate of anxiety within Germany and frustration over politics, the status quo, and give him a whole lot of power.
Yeah, they're literally pushing people into the arms of the far right by not talking about this, because they're going to the only people that will. And this erosion of that taboo of the far right in Germany over the last few years is just remarkable. I bet most of those people who were out there and were not far right supporters but standing out there 5 years ago wouldn't have wanted to go near these neo-Nazis with a barge pole.
Yeah.
Who, they wouldn't have wanted to be seen dead at a rally where people were doing Nazi salutes. But when they're the only people that will talk about their problems, well, then they'll go out. Then they'll start to join with them. And then they'll start to say things as well, like, well, maybe these guys aren't all bad. Maybe they've got some good ideas. Maybe some of the other things that they're saying is true. And your point about a strongman is, that's exactly where we've seen this trend go already in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about the strongmen in Eastern Europe before, men like Viktor Orban, where you've had people stand up against migrants and been really popular for it. Over the summer, we've just seen this dramatically in Italy, where they've got Matteo Salvini, and he's being really strong on migrants. Europeans are rescuing migrants in a boat. They've got a boat of 100 migrants, and he's saying, no, you can't land in Italy. You've got to find somewhere else to take them. We are not letting that boat in our country. And it sounds harsh. It sounds like something that would probably be unpopular, but it's not. His approval rating is soaring. The Italians love that, and they love now they want a strongman who will stand up and just make those statements, will stand up in his case to the entire EU and challenge them. And so you can see you can see the appetite in Germany really there to rally very quickly behind exactly the same kind of strongman. And what we're seeing in Germany right now, it conforms precisely to what we've been saying for years, because that forecast that we've been making for years is based on the Bible. You've got very specific scriptures in places like Daniel chapter 8 and Daniel chapter 11 that talk about a strong leader rising in Germany. Now you're seeing strong leaders rising all across Europe, and you're seeing unrest in Germany. You're seeing dissatisfaction with the current political system. You're seeing the perfect conditions for a strongman. So just exactly what you would expect based on those Bible prophecies. And there's a host more on this subject, and the Bible gives us a whole load more information about what is coming to Germany, and you can read a lot of that in our free book, A Strong German Leader is Imminent.
Richard has an article on thetrumpet.com called Civil War on the Streets of Germany. You can go check that out. And it also links to that 2016 article. So definitely keep your eye on what's happening over there. We appreciate that, Richard. Another big story, if you've been following events in Syria the last few years, you know this Middle East hotspot has taken a number of surprising twists and turns. We've been tracking it all from the perspective of Bible prophecy, which forecasts the ultimate outcome in Syria. Another quite intriguing development this past week seems to make that outcome more likely. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
The critical thing that we're watching for in Syria is for the Syrian government to lose its favor with Iran, or at least the Iranian-Syrian relationship to break up. And so that's what we've been looking for 6 years. And that is, Bible prophecy says, that that relationship will break up, even though Iran has been one of the strongest supporters of the Assad regime. Even though without Iran, the Assad regime would have fallen inside the Syrian civil war. But for the first time this week, we observed, and there were reports, that we had pro-Iranian militias fighting directly against Syrian regime Assad's soldiers. This hasn't happened before in 6 years. And so when we're looking at this in terms of Bible prophecy, looking for a split, when we actually see those two allies turning and fighting against one another, this is something that is extremely important and something to take notice of.
What drove Iran to this point?
Well, it is interesting. This battle took place in the very eastern part of Syria, along the Iraqi-Syrian border, at a town that is very close to a border crossing, or includes a border crossing. We've talked a lot about Iran's desire to maintain this roadway, this thoroughfare that goes across Iraq from Iran's western border, across Iraq into Syria and then into southern Lebanon, so they can keep arming Hezbollah. And so Syria is critical for this, for Iran to have the weapons transfers and such to maintain pressure on Israel in southern Lebanon. And so these border crossings are critical that Iran maintains control of them. Well, the Assad regime apparently doesn't really want the Iranians to maintain its border crossings with Iraq. It would like to stay in control of these border crossings. And so the fighting took place. There's been reports about 25 people killed, including an IRGC commander, Iranian commander, including some belonging to the Afghani Shiite group, the Fatimiyan group that is led by the IRGC, and some of Assad's men as well. Apparently the battle, or this fight, has been going on for about a couple of weeks. I don't know if it's died down. There hasn't been reporting of it the last couple of days. This was earlier on this week. But it just speaks to the divergent interests of these two. We do know that Assad needs Iran, has needed Iran in the past, and so he's willing to accept Iranian patronage. But sometimes that goes too far, and that's what we've seen this past week.
So you're talking about, and we've discussed on recent programs, the desire Iran has to have this corridor that takes it all the way to the Mediterranean. That obviously runs right through Syria. It runs right through Lebanon. For Iran to basically lash out against the Assad regime, it shows just how much the situation has changed. People looking at this alliance would say that, but this would never fracture. But we've been saying, based on Bible prophecy, that it would. But the road that Iran has in order to maintain that, it seems like it's going to be tough for it to really secure that corridor, given the changes that we've seen, especially with respect to Russia's patronage and even Russia inviting Europe in to help out with Syria. It seems like Iran is going to have a much tougher time if it wants to secure that corridor.
I think so very much, especially as well, just another factor, Israel has been very obvious with its attacks on these Iranian convoys that are coming into Syria from Iraq. And so if Israeli jets are flying into Syria or flying close to the Syrian border, and they're attacking Iranian forces in Syrian territory, that could upset the Syrian president. And so he's got to make sure that his survival is preserved. And so looking forward, you've got a massive rebuilding process that's going to cost about $500 billion in Syria. And if Iran doesn't have the finances to rebuild Syria, and so if Syria is going to be stabilized for the future, and if that is going to be stabilized under Assad, he must be thinking, well, I have to really be cautious here and not to seem too pro-Iranian. And the only people with the money, it seems, isn't even Russia. They don't have any money. The only people with money that are willing to spend it in Syria, that have an interest in making sure Syria remains calm, is Europe. And so there is something going on in Assad's head. I read an article that basically said what we've been saying today, that said that it looked like Assad was wedded to the Iranian regime, and that Russia was keen to, you know, they didn't really care if Assad came or went. But they were saying that although the relationship with Iran is still, you know, it's not fully broken up yet, there has been some changes going on with Assad's decision making, and I think this battle proves it, that he is not allowing Iran to get what they want in Syria, and that is a big change.
So this does go along with what we've been prophesying, this split between Iran and Syria. What would be the main resource that you would point listeners to read about that prophecy?
Well, I'll have an article about this next week. It's been on the desk to keep on working on, so they can look forward to that, which will detail the prophecies and also our 6-year long forecast from our editor-in-chief that said Syria is going to fall out of the Iranian orbit in favor of a European patronage, and that article is how the Syrian crisis will end.
All right, thanks for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. An alliance of Asian nations holds regular anti-terrorism drills. One of these just wrapped up this week in Russia. And this year's drills included a couple of interesting first-time participants. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this was the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. They just held drills that lasted for a little over a week, and they wrapped up on Wednesday. Russia hosted these exercises in Chabarkul, which is just a little north of the Russia-Kazakhstan border there. And all of the longtime members of the SCO participated. So that's Russia, China, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. And then, as you said, what really makes these most recent drills notable is that their two new members, India and Pakistan, also took part. So it's the very first time India and Pakistan have participated in an SCO military drill since they became full members of the group last year. And this addition of India and Pakistan and the fact that they're now participating as full members really just boosts the SCO's geopolitical relevance. You know, first of all, it represents a massive expansion of the population mm-hmm. that's represented by the group. Right now, it's just under half of the world's people are, they live within SCO countries. And then about a quarter of total global GDP is now generated by SCO members. So that just means that the geopolitical footprint of this bloc is quite a bit larger and deeper. And these Peace Mission 2018 exercises even reflected that expansion in a way. There were around 3,000 soldiers participating from the 8 member nations. And that makes it the largest set of drills ever to take place under the SCO banner there. We've spoken on the show numerous times about Russia and China being really the main drivers of cooperation of Asian nations. And as we see more drills like this taking place all the time and see their size growing, it really shows that the SCO could be one of the main tools that Russia and China are using to advance that goal.
So India and Pakistan obviously aren't particularly friendly with each other, for them to enter the SCO to participate in these drills, and the fact that it was Russia that hosted these, the relationship between India and Russia is quite interesting from a prophetic standpoint. Maybe you could just talk about that.
Sure, yes. There is a lot of animosity between India and Pakistan, but not so much that it precludes them being able to work together in this. And then it's the same situation with India and China. They've recently made some agreements that do point to the stage being set for a real thaw between the India and China relations, but India and China still have a lot of tension between them. You know, India has been hindering some of the Belt and Road Initiative progress in the region there, and then China's also been building up its military presence in the Indian Ocean. So there's a lot of tension there, but with India and Russia, it's totally different. Those two are very, very close. They have a robust trade partnership. They cooperate across a wide range of issues, including vast amounts of defense purchases that India makes from Russia. And so now that India is participating as a full-fledged SCO member, Russia and India are poised to draw even closer together. And all of this is significant because Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has identified Russia and not China as the main power that will lead an end-time group of Asian countries that the Bible calls the Kings of the East. That's in Revelation 16, verse 12. And then Ezekiel 38 is the scripture that's informed his identifying Russia as the head of that bloc. So it's interesting because most analysts and pundits think of the SCO as being mostly dominated and led by China.
Mm-hmm.
Militaristically and economically, China is the most powerful nation in the bloc, so that makes sense. But now that India is in the group, you could really see how Russia could begin becoming far more powerful within the bloc and just calling more of the shots.
And I guess just the overall point about just how these Asian nations are coming together, and here the SCO, this security alliance, adding two nuclear armed nations to it, it really does increase the power of that that organization. And you could see the alignment of these Asian giants continuing to grow, as we expect based on Bible prophecy. If you want more information, where would you send people?
We have an article that'll be going up probably over the weekend about these specific drills and about what they point to, and also The Prophesied Prince of Russia by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry takes a deep dive into all the relevant scriptures about the coalescing of the Asian nations.
All right, very good. We'll put links to those and all the other literature that we're talking about on the program at the Trumpet Hour Hub on trumpet.com. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. There are nations where public speech is tightly controlled by the government. China is one of them. But the United States is supposed to be a champion of free speech. There's evidence emerging, though, that various forms of censorship are taking place without our even realizing it. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, many of the big tech giants in the United States, Google especially, are increasingly being accused of breaking antitrust laws by censoring conservative speech. President Trump brought this roaring back into the public discourse this week in a tweet he did Tuesday, where he cited a PJ Media study that 96% of stories about him on Google News were negative. The study pointing out that it's not necessarily that 96% of all stories about Donald Trump are negative. There are sympathetic news outlets to him, but those ones don't show up on the Google search results. Mm-hmm. They found in the top 100 search results for the Trump news on Google, there was one link to Fox News, but National Review doesn't show up, Federalist doesn't show up, and this got a little bit of backlash. Trump was saying that Google was rigged against him, so the top story on Google News that day was a CNN report on how Google search results totally aren't rigged.
Well, there you go.
So that anyone, it did come back a couple days later, though. Yesterday, with the president sitting down with Bloomberg and elaborating a little bit more on what he meant, saying that, well, obviously Google's a private company, it can write its algorithms the way it sees fit. But he's saying that he thought there was evidence of a breach of antitrust laws, that they have a lot of lobbyist money, things like that, that just gives them a dominance over the internet market that they can exclude other viewpoints. And actually, Freedom Watch filed a lawsuit against Google just for that, for breach of antitrust laws. It's actually Larry Klayman, who was involved back during the Reagan administration in the lawsuit that broke up AT&T, has filed a lawsuit alleging that Google, Facebook, Twitter, Apple, and Instagram actually have a tacit agreement between them to keep conservative viewpoints off of their platforms, or suppress conservative viewpoints on their platforms. And so that would be five companies there that, if that agreement does exist, we'll see as the court case unfolds, would definitely be a breach of antitrust laws. President Trump himself isn't talking about breaking up Google. But this lawsuit would make that case, and one of his former, Mr. Trump's former advisor, Steve Bannon, was on CNN this week also making the case that Google needs to be broken up into more than one company to try to get some healthy competition back into the internet marketplace and bring back free speech to America.
I saw an interview recently with a scholar who was just studying the data, this type of skewing toward negative articles against the president of the government and that type of thing, and just said he contended that it could have as much of an impact on the elections this coming November as to skew 12 million votes away from more conservative candidates. Significant impact on our election, far more than say like the Russians who were, you know, posting Facebook ads. But it certainly is something that could have pretty drastic consequences for the nation.
Right. Yeah. Because, yeah, the Robert Mueller investigations made a huge deal about these 12 Russians with Twitter accounts and how they subverted American democracy. And if that's possible, you'd think that an organization like Google that just dominates the online marketplace of ideas, so many people use that if they are deliberately favoring one political party over the other, it's Napoleon Bonaparte said that I like fear one hostile newspaper more than a foreign legion, or something to that effect, is that it is just really powerful what news you receive, which is why you have regimes in like Iran and China that really do crack down on what their people can and can't read. Actually, there was a leaked report just recently that Google's currently not allowed in China, but they're actually working on a Chinese-friendly search engine that they can market into China, have Chinese people use it to Google things, but it will censor out information the Chinese government doesn't want them to know about. Mm. So the technology's there, and Google's preparing to use it in other nations. Now, whether they're using similar technological algorithms here to favor a political party is an interesting question. And I'm sure as some of these lawsuits unfold, we'll know more information. But as we've brought out on this program before, there is a very specific prophecy in the book of Amos, specifically in chapter 8, verse 11, says, "Behold, the day comes, says the Lord God, that I will send a famine in the land, not a famine of bread nor a thirst of water, but a hearing of the word of the Lord." And so that's a time for the end time when there's actually a famine here in the United States of hearing God's message, a time when there will be certain ideas that will be persona non grata, not allowed in the marketplace of ideas. You'll Google it and it won't be there because of this suppression of certain ideas. And that's something that right now isn't occurring against God's message. It might be occurring against some other ideas, but you can definitely see that the trend that prophecy can't be fulfilled in a nation that upholds First Amendment rights of being able to of free speech. Those are principles that have been very near and dear to Americans for the past couple centuries, but are being subverted and are going away.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, leaders in Serbia and Kosovo considering the explosive idea of redrawing their border, why Iran is moving some of its missiles into Iraq, China developing an aircraft carrier battle group, Chinese tech companies being accused of posing a national security threat to other nations. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The Balkans is one of the most volatile regions on the globe. It's riven by deep, often violent ethnic tensions. So it gets very touchy, even explosive, when leaders of some of these nations talk about redrawing national borders. But this is exactly what the leaders of Serbia and Kosovo are talking about right now. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this like you said, most explosive part of Europe is going through some major changes, some of its biggest changes in at least a decade, if not more, right now. You've got just last weekend, the leaders of Serbia and Kosovo had a summit together or had a speech together, and they said they were both open to the idea of changing their borders. This has been kind of talked about in the background for a few months now. Now it's out in the open. The EU, it has said they're going to host a negotiation between these two on September 7th, so in just over a week. And what this proposal would do would basically give some of Kosovo up to Serbia, where there are majority Serbs, maybe give some parts of Serbia, where there are majority Albanians, to Kosovo, and then these two would recognize they're in each other's independence. This would open the door then for both of these nations to be put on track to joining the European Union. And this comes at the time when Europe is moving much more into the Balkans. We spoke about this a few weeks ago on the show. You know, last year you had Montenegro being put on the path to joining NATO. Sorry, they're obviously geographically in the Balkans, but joining NATO. Then you had Macedonia and Albania being put on the path to EU membership, where they could have talks begin in 2019. So Europe's moving into the area, and then you've got this new proposal. And to me, what makes this really intriguing is this comes at the same time where we've got a bit of a focus on Germany and Russia meeting and talking. We've talked about some of these frequent meetings that they've had over the last few weeks. It's something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has put a lot of focus on in the last Trumpet issue. And right at the same time, you have these kind of once-in-a-decade changes going on in the Balkans. And this is an area of huge concern to both countries. Germany was right there behind getting Yugoslavia broken up in the first place. They've been the ones, they had the largest, or one of their largest overseas military missions ever was in Kosovo as the UN or the EU peacekeeping force there. They've proven consistently they're very focused on that region. At the same time, Vladimir Putin is really focused on the region. The breakup of Yugoslavia, and especially then the breaking up of Kosovo from Serbia, were huge humiliations to Russia, and Putin talks about it a lot. So at the same, so you know both of those two countries are going to be locked in and very involved in what's happening here.
Is it possible that this is that Russia and Germany are behind this reconciliation or this the opening of talks that we're seeing here?
I think they're definitely involved in some way. I think exactly what that relationship is very hard to discern. In a lot of ways, Germany is the one big holdup in the European Union that's not got at getting on board with this border partition agreement. So America has said, yes, we're okay with border changes. Russia is, well, they're always just okay with basically whatever Serbia is okay with. The EU has said we're okay with border changes. Germany and Angela Merkel have said no, we don't want that. Now, whether that's kind of a negotiating posture or whether it's more of something intractable, it's hard to see. But then again, if there's a disagreement here between Germany and Russia, you know that it's going to be one of the big things that they're talking about.
The Balkans is obviously an area that we've concentrated a lot of focus on over the years. And for all of the reasons that you've mentioned, how does this these talks between Serbia and Kosovo play into those prophetic trends we're watching?
The Balkans is just a great place to see any of these trends unfolding. I mean, this is where, say, Orthodox civilization, Catholic, German civilization, Islamic civilization all collide. And so you can learn a lot by watching what's going on there. We have our free book, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans, and that goes through the history of the 1990s. And it just uses that history to prove some really dramatic lessons about Germany and about the character and the status of modern Germany. The Bible has a lot of warnings, and we make a lot of warnings based on the Bible about Germany and what they're going to do in the future. You can get a lot of those warnings from the Balkans and seeing how they behaved there, how they went against the world there. So just like the Balkans was a reflection in the 90s of Bible prophecy being fulfilled, we could see that again over the next few weeks and months, because it ties into the same prophecies that we're watching now, the rise of Germany still. Then also this forecast that Germany and Russia are going to work together. So it's just going to be, it's a trend that's going to be very interesting to keep on watching, because in the past, the Balkans exposed the rise of Germany, and maybe with these negotiations and some significant shifts going on in that region, they could do so again.
All right. Thanks for that, Richard. We'll definitely keep our eyes on that volatile part of the world. Iran is under a lot of scrutiny for its weapons programs these days, and this week it revealed an extraordinary and very aggressive plan to sidestep that scrutiny. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, there was a blockbuster report that came out today from Reuters, which is based on intelligence officials from the West, from Iraq, Iranian officials as well, and it documented the fact that Iran has sent missiles into Iraq to be used by and controlled not by the Iraqi government but by the Shiite militias that answer directly to Iran, and that these weapons, these missiles, ballistic missiles, are moving towards the western side of Iraq, which will then make Israel, Saudi Arabia, become potential targets from Iranian-made missiles from Iraq.
One of the boldest prophecies that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory made in the earlier years of the Trumpet was that Iran would take over Iraq. And this seems like it about the clearest evidence that we have seen of just how far under Iran's influence Iraq has fallen.
Yeah, for sure. If anyone reads this Reuters report, and I would suggest they do, it's just amazing some of the quotes that you get from Iraqi officials that talk about how their country is being used by Iran as a forward military base. It said that our fingers are not on the control button for these rockets. These Shiite militias answer directly to the Quds Force leader, Qassem Soleimani. He's heading up this project. They even have... The report goes into weapons development facilities for these Shiites, Shiite militias inside Iraq that answers to Iran. And it is really interesting. It seems like ever since the Islamic State has lost a lot of its territory in Iraq, we've been making this point that Iran is going to fill in that void, has taken over. And if we can make that point about how the government is now turning heavily pro-Iran. We can make that point about how the Iranian Shiites are taking up their positions along the Syrian-Iraqi border, indicating that they control the territory all the way across. And now this is just another sign that we have these ballistic missiles that are capable of reaching Israel from Iraq. And this I don't know if it's a game changer or not, but I mean, this is Iran's tactic as far as it goes to confronting Israel. Hamas, what do? They can't come out of their territory, really. They fire missiles at Israel. Hezbollah's got 100,000 missiles pointing towards Israel right now. The Houthis in Yemen, they fired this week, I think there's been about 5 or 6 missiles fired into Saudi Arabia. Again, all ballistic, these ones are ballistic missiles, and this is Iran's tactics. And it does show, without a doubt, that Iraq has fallen to Iran. Iraqis are saying that. We can't control what they do. And that is stunning, and a stunning admission from the members, not necessarily the Iraqi government, but Iraqi intelligence officials.
And also, it just underlines the point about just how aggressive Iran is being. They would be this bold as to say, well, you know, you might try to shut us down within our own borders, but we have other options that we can take, and just points you back to that prophecy about what a pushy foreign policy Iran has. And you could see that this would provoke those, especially within Europe, as we know prophetically, to be that much more bold in trying to encircle them and to stop them.
Exactly. I mean, the Europeans are even calling them out on this. The French foreign minister called them out on this yesterday, saying that Iran needs to stop its temptations to be the regional hegemon. Obviously, the U.S. is upset by this. But Iran did this and have moved these missiles into Iraq in broad daylight, and they've commented on it. They're like, hey, we just need to be ready. They need to know that we can hit them if they hit us. There's no like fear of sanctions tearing apart their society. There's no even question that they're going to moderate. They feel like they're getting backed into a corner, and so they're going to fight. They're going to punch. They're going to kick and scream. And we see that with these missiles in Iraq. if somebody wants to read about our longstanding forecast of Iraq falling to Iran as part of this King of the South alliance that the Bible talks about, you can read an article that was in our January edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet this year. It's written by our editor-in-chief, and it's entitled America's Greatest Defeat, Iran's Victory.
Thanks for that, Brent. We've been talking about China's moves toward ruling the waves, challenging America's naval supremacy. Well, a major step in that direction is China's efforts to develop an aircraft carrier battle group. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Chinese Navy launched its first indigenously built aircraft carrier, the Shandong, for its second set of sea trials this week. So that does bring the People's Liberation Army Navy a pretty big step nearer to accomplishing its goal of having an aircraft carrier battle group. A few months ago, we talked on the Trumpet Hour, and we also wrote on thetrumpet.com about the first set of sea trials that the Shandong was deployed for. And that first set did end up revealing some deficiencies in the vessel. So they've been working in the months since then to correct those. And now it's out for round two. So this trial is designed to just test the Shandong's navigation and its communication capacity. It'll also test those corrections that were made in between the two deployments. And they expect that there will still be even a few more trials before the Shandong is commissioned into service officially by the Navy. But it's on schedule to enter sometime late next year. And meanwhile, China is just about to begin construction on its first catapult-capable aircraft carrier. So that'll be its third carrier, and that'll be a big step up from these first two, because not only does it enable a lot more aircraft to be on board, but they can be fixed-wing aircraft that can launch with the catapult technology there. So that just it makes for much more rapid flight operations in general. So we are seeing the Chinese aircraft carrier battle group really just being built before our eyes.
How big of a game changer are aircraft carriers and a nation's naval power?
It's a subject of a lot of debate. Some say that aircraft carriers are becoming obsolete in some ways with hypersonic missiles and things like that that could orchestrate an attack without having to have, you know, a plane or a missile close to the target. But I think that at least for projecting power, and if you wanted to do any sort of tactical operations that required ground forces with air support, having a blue water navy that can go to wherever you'd like to carry out these operations is vital. So I think that they, you know, having an aircraft carrier battle group like this is quite a game changer. It's still a long way off from the aircraft carrier situation with the United States, but the Chinese seem intent on closing that gap.
And that wasn't the only ship that China launched.
Right. Last Friday, the PLA Navy also launched the Nanchang. That's a Type 055 destroyer. They launched that one for its first set of trials. That's Asia's largest and most formidable non-carrier warship. And they have 112 vertical launching cells. So those are able to carry and launch a lot of missiles of all different types. So that makes it a real asset to the Chinese Navy. Right now, China has only this one Nanchang launched, and it's not yet commissioned into service, but they are currently building three others. And these are blue water capable. You know, unlike most of the vessels that the Chinese Navy currently has, they're blue water capable. That means they can navigate across the deep waters of the open oceans. They can escort China's aircraft carriers and just really extend the reach of a navy, of the Navy in a significant way. So ship by ship, port by port, China is building one of the main engines of international power, and that is an aircraft carrier battle group and just a modern naval force that's able to project power far from home. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that China's expanding naval capacity really should alarm the world, because it means that China is, quote, steering the world toward war. He wrote an article by that title in the Trumpet's July 2016 print edition. And he just really emphasizes the way China's Navy is designed to challenge seven decades of American naval dominance in the Pacific Rim. And he points to the fact that this is contributing to the fulfillment of a Bible prophecy in Deuteronomy 28:52 that talks about, it says, "He shall besiege you in all your gates." And that's referring to the U.S. mostly being besieged in its gates that it once controlled. So the stage is really being set for China to block the U.S. and the U.K. out of not just the vital trade routes near the Asian gates that they used to control, Sri Lanka, Singapore, and Hong Kong, but even those that are thousands of miles away from China, you know, Panama Canal, Falklands, maybe even Gibraltar, since China is developing a blue water navy, and since the scriptures also say that China will be working in conjunction with European nations to accomplish this. So we'll be sure to have a link to Mr. Fleury's very prescient article, "China is Steering the World Toward War," and it just puts China's rising naval might in the biblically prophetic context.
Okay, thanks very much for that. Two Chinese tech companies are being accused of posing a national security threat to other nations. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, Australia has a new prime minister now. Scott Morrison was elected last week. He becomes the 30th prime minister of Australia. We've actually have an article up on thetrumpet.com right now just showing some of the political ability in Australia, as this is actually their sixth prime minister in 11 years. And so it's been a while since anyone's gone full term.
Mm-hmm.
But he also presents some significant developments in Australia's relationships with China. Scott Morrison, he is very pro-Chinese trade. He's very pro-Chinese investment, but only certain types of Chinese investment. He's been more strict than some of his predecessors on investment that could be a threat to Australian critical infrastructure. Which brings us to the story that you mentioned, that there have been two major Chinese tech companies that have been moving into Australia and trying to integrate themselves with their 5G Wi-Fi infrastructure. Scott Morrison's administration has banned that deal on the ideas that the Communist Party of China is trying to tighten its grip on its technology companies and being able to have a Chinese company that integrated in Australia's 5G system presents espionage problems. In the United States, you hear a lot about, you know, like NSA tapping phones and things like that. It's like, well, if you give a Chinese telecommunications company that type of control into your phone networks, your 5G Wi-Fi systems, things like that, that could definitely be used for the communist government in China to spy on Australians. And the new prime minister is really cracking down on that. It's kind of a sign of some of the awakening realizations of the national security threat a lot of these commercial and investment deals with China can pose. China's the biggest merchandise exporter into Australia, huge investor into Australia, has bought up mines, bought up agricultural land. You even have like Chinese billionaires who are major contributors to the major political parties in Australia. There's actually a professor in Australia, Professor Clive Hamilton, who's written a book called Silent Invasion that goes through a lot of these statistics about Chinese lobbying in Australian political parties, Chinese investment, and making the case that this is actually a Chinese invasion. He made the statement that the end game is to break Australia away from American alliance and essentially turn Australia into a kind of client state for China. We've covered before how China's really trying to rise to prominence in the Indian Ocean region, taking over the South China Sea, establishing ports along the north coast of the Indian Ocean, developing close relationships with the East African nations on the east side of the Indian Ocean, and slowly but surely trying to turn Australia into a client state that ranks up the other side of the Indian Ocean. And this new banning of the telecommunications deal shows that the current leadership in Australia is kind of starting to push back against some of the these more critical infrastructure deals. But the overall trend of Australia just becoming completely reliant on the Chinese economy proceeds apace. From a prophetic standpoint, this is actually one of the key prophecies that Jesus Christ himself uttered in Luke 21:24, where he talks about, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled. That's towards the end part of that verse. And so this phrase, the time of the Gentiles, infers that before the time of the Gentiles fulfills, there was a time of the non-Gentiles, or a time of the Israelites. And as longtime listeners of this show, United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, these are Israelite nations, the literal descendants of the lost 10 tribes of ancient Israel. And so now we're moving into a standpoint where, like Professor Clive Hamilton says, where China's breaking this band of alliance between Australia and America and trying to turn Australia into a client state of a non-Israelite power. And this is just a powerful trend. You see the rise of these Gentile nations like Germany and Russia and Iran and China around the world.
All right. Thank you for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and literature we discussed on the program. You can email us your thoughts on the program today to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here.
Great to be here.
Take care. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Dwight Eisenhower. We succeed only as we identify in life or in war or in anything else a single overriding objective and make all other considerations bend to that one objective. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.